question for us is not transferring agency over to kids, because kids have total agency over what they learn and when they learn it. And the problem with education is that kids are learning all the time, just not our stuff.
And welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Modern Learners Podcast. I'm Will Richardson, and it's great to be back after what was a bit of a planned hiatus and unplanned hiatus thanks to Hurricane Irma. And what you heard there at the beginning was a little snip of a frustrated me after coming back a little bit tired, a little bit ornery, reading some stuff about learning that Bruce and I spend about 40 minutes talking about. Once again, looking at the language that we use when we begin to discuss what learning is and what it means for education. So hope you enjoy this episode, and I'm hoping we'll be back on a more regular basis moving forward. Just a reminder, if you are interested in Change School, we just started our third cohort, but there's a little sign up to be read, to be notified on our Change School page. That's at change.school. Also, don't forget to join us at our Modern Learners Facebook group and lots of other places online. We look forward to engaging in these really important and high bar conversations around what change looks like. And we also have a bit of an announcement coming up in a couple weeks of another way that you can participate in the work that we're doing to, like I said, raise the bar and really talk about change at a higher level for not just leadership, but also for anyone who's interested in education. But for now, just sit back and relax and enjoy this this conversation about how language needs to change when we talk about education. And thanks again for listening.
So, Will, very pleased to actually see that you're back home. I didn't know that we're ever going to continue. I thought Modern Learners might end up being in Puerto Rico and Australia.
It's been some eventful things happening between podcasts. So we've had an interesting summer, and I know that, you know, people have been waiting anxiously for our next broadcast / podcast. Yes, we finally made it back, and I am back from Hurricane Irma. that stranded me in Puerto Rico. You know, just on a serious note, just a horrible week. I mean, obviously for us here in the States, 2 weeks actually between Harvey and Irma, and you know, the little piece of it that I felt was certainly nothing compared to the devastation that other people have been going through right now. So
it must have been an interesting experience.
Well, you know, It was pretty stressful, to be honest with you, because I kept looking at the map, seeing one after the other, you know, and we knew that it was going to pass somewhat to the north of us, which it did. We were in Puerto Rico, for those who haven't been following my Twitter feed and my Facebook feed with all the maps and everything. But but you know, we knew that it wasn't, we were never scared. We got about 50, 60, 70 mile per hour gusts. I mean, we felt it. There was no question, but it wasn't a question of, you know, life or safety or anything like that, but it was just, we didn't know if we'd be able to get off the island because we were in a part that, infrastructure was not great. To put it mildly, and we lost power right away. And, but anyway, worked out. But it was an interesting few days trying to get home. But again, I don't want to in any way suggest that was that minor hiccup in my life comes anywhere close to what other people are experiencing. So I feel very, really fortunate about that part, at least.
I know it's been talked about a lot in the past, but I'm just interested in the role that social and technology had while you were down there. Did it make you feel more comfortable? Did you get more information? Were you able to connect to more people?
I think I tweeted at some point, you know, my definition of binge learning right now is about hurricanes. And I was definitely binge learning. I found a couple of people on Twitter who I found just fascinating. Ryan Maui was one, and then another who are weathermen who were, you know, just constantly giving updates and sharing predictions and these beautiful graphics and stuff. I mean, it was amazing. I mean, the detail and the amount of information. But what was also really cool about it was that they admitted freely that they really had no clue. I mean, they had a little bit of a clue, but they didn't know exactly what was going to happen. Yep. So, and to be honest, when we did have power and we were kind of watching the cable networks, I mean, that was it. I don't think I'm ever going to watch cable television again, because you could get, you could sense that they were hoping for the devastation to happen almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, you could hear it. And when it, when it started going sideways a little bit, you know, not that they were openly disappointed, but yeah, it was not television's best hour by any stretch. I don't
it
think.
Does, but anyway. Don't you think it highlighted the difference between the public media and social media?
Oh yeah, no doubt.
Social, so one-to-one, one-to-a-few.
But and you know what? But the interesting thing too was that there were these very kind of interesting debates that were happening about climate change and the extent to which, you know, these hurricanes are being caused by that. And this guy, you know, this one guy who I was following, this Ryan guy, it was just very interesting the way that he articulated his perspective that you couldn't connect it to, because certainly I'm in that camp that says a lot of this stuff is happening because of what we've done, you know, that we have contributed to this and that we have a huge responsibility right now to do something about it. Yep. And not that, you know, again, not that we want to be able to connect these two things, but it was just, again, it was just interesting and the different threads that I was able to follow. And it was a real learning experience as much as it was kind of this interesting family story that we'll have to tell, you know, getting stuck in Puerto Rico, which again, could be worse places to get stuck. But anyway,
I think it's good to be home. It was good because by complete coincidence, there was probably a fairly recent television series called Soundtracks, which goes back over critical events in the music of the times. And the one that they were obviously dealing with this week was 9/11. But concurrently, they were looking at Katrina. And I'd forgotten that Katrina went the other way. Katrina was due to hit Florida. And did a left turn and went straight down the middle to New Orleans, and you know, that just shows you how fickle the weather is. At the same time, I've also got a, and with the, you know, we're trying not to get political in these sessions, but you know, I think you should take comfort in North America, in the US. The challenges you've got with, you know, climate issues and the leadership's position on climate. You should feel comfort that our country's taking the same sort of indecision.
Makes me feel better.
And yeah. So we
thanks a lot, Bruce.
You probably haven't noticed, but our country doesn't have much sun, and we don't have much wind.
Oh no,
and
no.
We don't have much choice. So we're still stuck without you know, any trade, any emissions trading scheme. And so every time we have these extreme weather events, though, it does bring it to the point. But,
well, and I mean, you know, it was, again, not to joke about it, but I mean, we have huge wildfires burning in the West. We have these hurricanes, you know, hitting major cities. We have the earthquake, the major earthquake in Mexico City. I mean, you know, there were people who were, again, not joking, but saying, you know, the end of the world is upon us, right? Because all of this stuff is just happening at the same time. And it does give you pause, you know?
Yeah, if nothing else.
But then again, we've had wildfires forever. We've had hurricanes forever. We've had earthquakes forever. These in and of themselves are not unusual occurrences, but I think the ferocity of that hurricane, especially Irma, you know, when it was churning in the Atlantic, that was a beast of a storm. And you know, it just makes you think.
Well, it brings us to the point of asking, when are we going to agree that something's going on? I mean, that's the point.
Well,
you know, is it a 50-year cycle? Is it a 100-year cycle? Because that's the argument, essentially. That, you know,
I don't think anyone's ever, but I don't think anyone's ever going to be able to say definitively, you know, and that's what the problem is, you know.
That's right.
That's one of the problems with all of this. And again, you know, I wonder how, as I think about all this stuff and read all this stuff, how are we talking about this in schools? You know, how are we discussing climate change? Are we too scared to even talk about it because of the politicization of it, you know, and the kind of arguments that are happening about it? I mean, my sense of it is that more and more these days in schools, we just avoid that stuff. You know, we don't really want to go there, which I think is the worst case scenario, but especially here in the States. Yeah.
the free speech thing, and I think it is negligent not to engage in the topic. I think that I can understand there is some, we'll just say, you know, certain views that say we shouldn't take the extreme position of believing that, you know, the world is going to fall apart and we do have this issue upon us now. But at the very least, we should be having a lot of discussion about the topic, sure. Surely. It's a very, I mean, just for your own reference, in Australia, you know, I think and listeners and viewers may or may not know, but Australia is the only country in the world that doesn't believe that our seasons change with the solstice like the rest of the world. So we theoretically are in our spring, you're in your fall. So you're still in your winter, you're still in your summer.
Yes, we are.
We're in our spring. We're in our spring because we do it the first of the month. You do it in the 21st. So let's assume, just for a brief second, Australia kept in line with the earth, with nature, with whoever else is doing this stuff. We're still in winter and Sydney's about to have a day today of 94 degrees. Now, by any measure, in winter, that's a fairly warm day for Sydney.
Yes, it is.
Now, but it surely, you don't go into a school and you don't say to your kids, hey, is this worth talking about, you know? Is this something, you know, because you can have an open mind about it. I agree that you shouldn't walk into kids and say, you know, wow, climate change is upon us, because I don't think we know. But we certainly should be having those discussions.
Well, and, you know, I'm reminded when you said that, you know, the earth is falling. The earth is going to be fine.
Yeah.
The planet is going to survive. Yeah. It's just a question of what happens to its inhabitants, you know. So, I mean, the earth doesn't care if there's earthquakes or hurricanes or whatever else or why they're caused. I mean, it's just, right. You know, that's just the natural reaction of what's happening. So, yeah,
so speaking of the end of the world, it's sort of a bit of the end of the world the way we're using language today. I think today's been a day where...
Is this the segue into what?
Can people get that?
This for those is of very, you who maybe are very it, subtle. This is the segue. Get to the topic for the day.
So you woke up today from your post-hurricane experience.
Well, so let me just say, I didn't, not that it's an excuse, but I got home, we landed at 5 a.m. on Sunday, and then I had to take my kid to school, and I didn't get any sleep, and yesterday was just a catch-up day. So I was still tired when I woke up this morning, but I felt a little bit more, you know, like energized to go online and start reading stuff, and I knew about 5 minutes in that was not...
Not a good thing?
Was not a good idea, no, because I started reading a whole bunch of stuff that was just, again, driving me crazy in terms of the way that we talk about student-centered learning and, you know, creating these environments for learning to happen. And, I mean, there was one, I tweeted it out, and I'm going to just read my tweet here because I just want to make sure I get it right. But I read somewhere that one of the articles said that teachers, talking about teachers, we need to design student-centered learning experiences. And it was just like, does anybody read that and not feel the irony in that we, the adults, need to design student-centered learning experiences?
Yeah.
Is that even possible to do? I don't think, I think there's a missing, something's missing in that statement, right?
Yeah, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy. What response did you get? Much feedback on Twitter?
No. No, because, you know, it was the ornery Will who, you know, nobody pays attention to that. But no, but you know what I'm saying, right? And it's like we just take that language and we just, we
appropriate it.
You know, we just don't even think about it. We don't parse it in any way so that it makes sense. And I tweeted after that, too, that, you know, just gentle reminder, everyone in education, students already have total ownership over their learning. They already have it. You know, we don't give them that stuff. The question for us is not transferring agency over to kids, because kids have total agency over what they learn and when they learn it. And the problem with education is that kids are learning all the time, just not our stuff. Right? And that's what we want them to learn, our stuff. So that's why we're going to create these experiences for them, so they will want to learn our stuff more. And that just drives me insane, because that misses the point. That's like, you know, sure, you've got traditional education. We're just the delivery mechanism that's down here. Then you've got this kind of discussion that's starting to happen now that says, well, you know, we have to help kids, you know, we have to give kids more agency, or we have to, you know, do this and that. And I'm kind of going, well, yeah, but it's still our stuff. You know, it's still about us. And that's why, you know, we talk about this all the time, but, you know, personalized learning, blended learning, all that stuff. It's really personalized teaching, blended teaching, flipped teaching, right? Because it's not about kids learning. It's about us teaching in the way that we teach our stuff.
That's
right. So, you know, what drives me really crazy is that we just think that if kids aren't learning our stuff, they're not learning. And that's just not true. They're learning all the time.
Yep.
Where we need to get to is up here, where we understand that real agency and real learning happens when the conditions are created for kids to have the choice over the what, over the how, and all that type of stuff, if we really want to develop kids as learners. But we just don't. We just don't go there. We read this stuff and we just go, we need to do this.
Is that sense of us not accepting that? Is that a sense of us not accepting that? One, is it got to do with a lack of trust, that we just don't trust that kids are going to know what to learn, when to learn, how to learn it? They're just going to basically goof off and fill in time. Is that, that's the one extreme of it? Or is it two, that we, and I'm using the royal we as educators, as teachers, is that just that we don't know what we should be doing? If kids are going to go off and do their stuff, then if we're not going to do our traditional teaching of content and pouring it down, what then are we going to do? And I think, do you think it's both, either, or which of those do you think is the problem?
What do you think?
I think it's both. And I do think that people, my experiences, and I've, you know, worked in schools where this has been the case, I do think that people, what happens is, firstly, if you walked into any classroom, and we'll pick 12-year-old kids, and all of a sudden, you know, start of a year, this year, you know, right now, start of the school year in the northern spheres, you decided that you were going to sort of move towards a more learner-centered environment. Immediately it happens, you're going to get some kids who are going to do exactly what I just said. They're going to goof off. They're not going to know what to do. And then within about a month, someone's going to walk in and say, see, I told you it was hopeless. These kids don't know how to discipline themselves. They don't know what decisions to make. And, they, you know, because they've been doing the other stuff for 10 years or 8 years, they've been through a culture of someone telling them how to behave. If you work with really young kids who come in and basically have gone through a play-based learning environment in their early childhood environment and are structured in the way they go about their work and about their diligence and their focus towards what they want to do, that's a whole different story, as we know from experience from schools that we've worked with. So firstly, I think that people do not have, they don't basically trust that kids will make good decisions about their own learning. And secondly, I think there is, and I, by the way, I can understand that. I don't think it's unreasonable. I think that, but I think if you're gonna test kids on their trust, I think you've got to do it properly. You just don't walk in and say, oh, by the way, after 8 years of this stuff, we're now going to change. We're going to give you a month to work it out. And if you don't work it out, we're going to go back to what we did. The second part of that is, I think it is very reasonable that teachers aren't sure about what their role will be. How will they go? And I think the big question with that is, it's actually more difficult. It's much easier to be able to walk in and say, today we're going to deal with this topic. I've prepared this before I came in.
Oh, absolutely.
As opposed to when I walk in and you walk in and we walk into an inquiry-based environment, which is learner-centered, and we can name dozens of schools like that. And these teachers, they're working hard because they're working on the fly. They're reacting to the kids. They're responding to them. They're challenging. They're provoking them. They're supporting them. They're guiding them. That's much harder. That's a much harder environment to be working in.
Well, and I mean, you know, we talk about this stuff all the time, and I'm sure some of this is probably repetitive because we come back to this all the time.
Yep.
But I just think that, and this is going to get me in trouble, and people are tweeting this session, by the way, Bruce, just so you know, they're listening and they're tweeting because I just saw one tweet. And this is going to get me in trouble. But I think I'm coming to the opinion that we are much too precious about ourselves as teachers.
Yeah, cool. That's
right. You know, and I mean that with respect. You know,
I know you do. Absolutely.
You know, and again, you think about professional development, and it's all about practice. It's all about teaching. It's not about learning. And you think about the syllabus, which was another one that I read this morning, that drove me off. In fact, that quote may have been out of that one about the syllabus. How we need to create more student learning, you know, student-centered learning experiences. You think about the lesson plan. You think about all of these types of things. I mean, we, as much as we talk about giving up control, at the end of the day, you know, I had this conversation the other day, a couple of weeks ago too, with a group of teachers. We were talking about grades, right?
Yep.
And basically, we got hung up on it, right? Because everybody was like, yeah, grades suck. You know, grades aren't that great. They're not a great motivator, whatever else, but we have to give grades. And I was like, well, why? I mean, why do you have to give grades? Why can't you do exhibitions or portfolios or performances or a whole bunch of other stuff that people are doing? Uh-huh. Well, you know, because, you know, fill in the blank type of thing.
Yep.
We talk about it, but we don't get to the point where we really, really believe it and really, really do it in terms of this whole student agency thing. So, yeah, I mean, and so there was another post too, just really briefly, by Mike Caulfield, who's another blogger that, you know, I think he's great. And it was called "The Students as Creators and the Theology of the Attention Economy," which is great, right?
Did you read it? Yeah.
And he was talking about the fact that, you know, this idea of students as creators, you know, isn't really, I mean, it's not floating his boat. He says the rhetoric, and it is, you know, and we started this, your wonderful segue into this, Bruce, which is really, really good. But, you know, about the language and the way we talk about it and the words that we use, that's what it's all about, right? And he says the rhetoric around students as creators is unbelievably bad. It parrots all of capitalism's worth theology. We want to make makers, not takers. We value doers, not thinkers. And he goes, as I said a few years back, the idea that universities should value producers and push our students toward production is actually the least subversive idea you could possibly have at a university, right? So, you know, just the point being that, again, I just think that we use a lot of this language because it sounds different, but it's really not different.
That's right.
You know, we just have just made, we've just become really good at talking change, but
I was just thinking about that. So is it because deep down, because as our listeners, viewers will know, readers will know, all three of them, will know that, you know, we're about aligning practice to belief. And I think when we talk about beliefs, people usually sit in the camp and they go, yeah, you know what? We agree with you. You know, when we talk about beliefs around learning, you know, and how do you articulate those people? But then to make the link, to actually put that into practice, I think a lot of people just find that just too big a leap. So what happens is they want to say they're going there, but they're actually not being there. And it's not that they're trying to mislead people. It's just that it's a big step. It takes courage, dare we say the word, takes commitment, takes belief in your beliefs. How strongly do you believe what you're saying? I mean, at what point are you going to really look back and stand back and say, am I aligning my practice with my beliefs? And I think where some of this language misinterpretation, appropriation, trivialization comes from.
And I think that most of it comes from the fact that we just don't articulate it, you know.
No,
and that's really been one of my favorite weeks in Change School, and that's coming up next week, not this week, but next week, where, you know, we just say to people, what do you believe and what are you doing?
Yep.
And let's just unpack that a little bit, right? And you know, where are the gaps and why? Why do those gaps exist?
Yeah.
And which of those reasons for the gaps are real and which of them are just kind of fabricated to make us feel better? You know, to make us feel like, well, we can't do what we believe because, most of the stuff that we use as an excuse for not actually doing what we believe around learning is just kind of made up because it's too hard, as you suggested just a few minutes ago. It's really, really hard to make that shift. You know, somebody mentioned in response to my tweet this morning, they mentioned Sudbury schools, which we've talked about before too, you know, Sudbury Valley schools, which are highly democratic and basically give kids almost total agency, you know?
Yep.
those kids go to college. If that's your measure of success, those kids go on to those traditional, yep. you know, expectations and outcomes and whatever else. So what's the barrier there? You know, I mean, there are no barriers in that philosophy in terms of agency over learning, what you believe about how kids learn, and then doing it, actually making that happen. Or I shouldn't even say making, see, there we go, because that suggests that the teacher is the one. It's just allowing that to happen and then being there, you know, to support it.
But the other irony or paradox of all this is that I would have to say that when I've been, and I won't name the schools because I'm going to talk about their practice, but I've been in some of what are called the absolute Ivy schools, the elite schools in both North America and in Australia, where they've actually unleashed themselves from these limitations, these things like syllabus and curriculum. And for instance, I remember a mathematics class that I was in, which was a senior maths class. And I would, the pedagogy in that maths classroom would have done well in Sudbury. And this was, here I was in was about a $50,000 a year private school in, we'll just say, the northern states. And what had happened, of course, was because the teacher there, who I think was one of the best I've ever seen, understood that, you know, this was the way that learning should happen, that he was aligning his practice with his beliefs. But what he did have was complete freedom inside this school, because he was treated as a learning professional. Now, when you're in an elite, you know, high, you know, Ivy school or whatever else you want to call it, maybe that's what happens. Maybe that's where you do have your beliefs in yourself and your administration believes in you, and they trust you as the learning professional. Yeah. And probably, you know, my post this week in Shifting Conversations is about us trying to see ourselves as learning professionals, because I don't think the public dialogue at the moment allows that in most countries. I think it does certainly in some countries, which, you know, we know about, a lot of the Nordics and other places, and certainly in places like Singapore, and actually in New Zealand too. New Zealand, as we've posted about in the newsletter, is in 10 days' time has an election, which is going to have a huge impact on where they go from an educational perspective, because you and I both believe that New Zealand's has a pretty good structure for its government system. They do treat, by and large, I'm generalising, but they have a lot more freedom within guidelines about, you know, where they take their learning with the kids and within the classroom. You know, that's evident when you walk and work with New Zealand teachers and New Zealand kids. But if we're going to allow teachers to have the confidence and have this trust in their kids, we do have to have a more prominent, I think, impact in the public debate, in the broader media. You know, there's too much of this syllabus curriculum. I mean, I think I also mentioned to you my little wake-up call. I didn't come out of a hurricane, but I might as well have. Was, you know, this article that was posted in our local Fairfax paper in Australia, which is a good national newspaper, was supposed to be. And it's a reprint of an article out of the Telegraph in England. And the headline is, "Teachers have 10 years before robots take over." Quote from University Vice Chancellor in the UK. And it's all based on the same rubbish. It's absolute. It is the whole premise of the article, the assumptions made in that article, are patently wrong. But who's leading the discussion? I mean, it's a university vice chancellor who should know better. And yet when you read through it, you go, well, really?
Well, but, you know, so if current definitions, let's talk about the language again, right? If current definitions of student achievement are what you That's want, right. well, then that article That's is right. probably accurate.
Yep.
Because we're going to, you know, student achievement is simply about measuring the measurable. Pretty much. And, and we've talked about this before too, but, you know, no one wants to admit about student achievement is that the achievement goes away as soon as the grade is processed, you know, as soon as the grade is posted.
Yep.
Well, yeah, they achieved a 93. Right. Bring them up again in 6 months. See what they've achieved, you know, in that time. You know what I'm saying, right?
Yep.
So, but we never talk about that. We never want to. I mean, I bring that up, you know, I we've talked about this, but I bring up that story about Lawrenceville Prep, you know, the school here in New Jersey that decided to give, this was many, you know, 5-6 years ago now, but they decided to take one of their courses And I think we may have dropped from Facebook there. I saw the little Facebook icon.
No, it came up. No, we're cool.
Okay. Hi, Facebook. Anyway, you know how they decided to give their kids the same test 3 months after they took it. And they, you know, went from like an 87 to a 58. So which one's the achievement? I mean, what basically, what's more representative of that? But yet, we all want better, higher student achievement.
Yep.
So, you know, you talk about who's leading the narrative. Well, there's a whole bunch of people who are heavily invested in student achievement.
Yep.
In the way that it's currently construed.
Yep.
So, you know, and everybody knows that it's ridiculous. it's just insane to suggest that, you know, my kid got a 85 in calc that he achieved an 85. I mean, he'd get a 50 today, maybe a 30 in 6 months. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just a crazy measure.
But I think a lot of people who are listening to us might also be saying, okay, guys, we agree with you, but you know, what are the alternatives? But more importantly, how do we articulate this argument? How do we build this argument to a broader community? How do we build a better understanding across the wider community so that it's not just, you know, a handful of people or, you know, the rogues of the sort of profession who are out there saying this. We've got to build consensus. We've got to build support for the ideas that we're talking about, which I know is what we're doing in Change School. And it does give us another segue into the fact that we're about to kick off our third cohort in Change School. Really pleased that we've got another great team of people who've signed up for this next 8 weeks program. And it's going to be exciting to work with them and help them build these ideas and build the language to be able to express themselves clearly within their community about why we're doing this and what we're trying to achieve. But, you know, we've got to try and do this, you know, as openly and widely as we can, because there is a problem when you have, what do we say, 4 articles published this morning that are using language that's just grossly inappropriate.
Many more than that. Many more.
Yep.
That was like 4 out of the first 10 articles that I read this morning. I was just kind of going, you know, like.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that we didn't talk about, and we're not going to talk about, although I'm finding interesting, one of the interesting debates or conversations we're having in Change School, obviously, is about the XQ project.
Yeah.
The fact that it took over, literally took over all network television in the States last night.
I was subtle about the way that I tried to refer to it, because to a non-American, I've got to say, it was interesting. I enjoyed the music. I quite liked some of those singers.
Did you watch it? It was on in Australia too?
The dancing, no, it was streamed. I watched the streamings and the replays. I thought the dancing was really nice. I enjoyed the dancing. What I thought was really sad though, was that I think this is well-intentioned. I think that
I do too.
As with a lot of these, I'll call them celebrity initiatives, and no offense to Lorene Powell-Jobs, but these are celebrity initiatives, and I, to be fair, I'll throw some others in there. You know, you can throw in anyone from Tiger Woods to Bill Gates to Mark Zuckerberg. Andre Agassi. Let's just say they are well-intentioned. But educators, where the heck are you? I mean, how about we decided we're going to take some of these initiatives and they're going to be led by well-respected, well-informed educators who are going to help them make good choices in this?
Well, to be fair with the XQ project, I think that there are some great ideas that have been designed by educators in an attempt to, you know, to pursue under the, you know, kind of context of that project. But my problem again is that at the end of the day, in the 10 that were awarded, I think there are either 6 or 7 charter or new schools or whatever. Yep. I think there are 3 kind of public schools that have been around for a while and maybe, you know, off a little bit on the numbers, but you know what I'm saying, right? And the conversation always kind of returns to, well, how does this scale for the kids in my school down the road over here? And in schools in Camden and in, you know, all those places around the country and the world, in fact. that aren't going to be able to get $1 million or $2 million or whatever else. And, you know, people will say, you know, people will say, basically, well, there are ideas that we can aspire to. And I agree with that. I mean, I'm not suggesting that, that we should ignore the
projects or anything like that. I agree.
But I do think that, the work is more around how do we get traditional schools to change? And, you know, that's the kind of work that we're doing.
I think also, to be fair, you know, if I talk about the initiative from Gates and others, I know that when Gates' foundation first launched, and by it was, I know it was by accident, I won't go into the details, but by accident, the first thing they did was said, well, let's just give a chunk of cash to some schools doing cool stuff without anything like the processes, say, that XQ went through. But some of those schools were amazing schools. The best example I can think of is probably Big Pictures. You know, and what that original Gates money did to help Big Picture, and by the way, High Tech have benefited from it, so did New Tech and a few others. Yep. Now, they threw a lot of money around and some of it stuck, and some of it stuck in brilliant places. And for instance, what happened to Big Picture was amazing, and I'd say the same about High Tech particularly. But I mean, that, you know, I think we agree. I was trying to be respectful when I said that about XQ. It wasn't that I think that this was a bad thing. I mean, it wasn't like some of the other celebrity initiatives which have just been the Superman initiative and other sorts of things, I think, which have just been completely off the beam. But I just lament the fact that so much money, and we're now talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars, is being spent in the way it is. And that we've got to take a leadership position within the profession to ensure that we can impact on the widest number of people over time. And I think it's really hard. I think it's hard to understand what they were doing with XQ. I think the fact that they took such over the networks, and they sort of, you know, a lot of the short videos about school were very, very relevant and very, and they were extraordinarily produced. But as you said, we've got to be dealing with the day-to-day schools. We've got to deal with public schools in your local neighborhood who are able to do these things. And that's what really matters.
And as we wind this up, to come back again to the language, because I think you and I both agree that the conversation that XQ is having is a good one, but it's not the right one. I think it's more of doing the wrong thing right.
Very much so.
So imagine,
very, very much so.
Imagine if we had taken $100 million and invested it in changing the language.
Yeah.
So that when we, you know, when if we had a kind of consensus, a coherent idea of what learning is and started there.
Yeah.
Imagine what we could do in schools. I mean, all schools, right? Because, you know, we talk about this all the time. The irony about all this money stuff is that learning doesn't cost any money.
No.
Creating environments where kids learn deeply and powerfully and have agency and do all the things that we believe about learning doesn't cost a freaking dime at the end of the day in terms of changing stuff, right?
Yeah.
Because it's just culture. It's just the environment and the conditions. And, you know, we talk about that all the time. So that's the sad part to me. I mean,
but do you think though that what we're seeing though is, I think there has to be one thing for sure. I think they're now, whether it's XQ or any of these initiatives and including our work, I think there is now almost universal agreement that schools have to change. I think that most of the change is, as you said, being focused on doing the right thing wrong. And doing the wrong thing right, sorry, the wrong way around, the wrong thing right. But I think that's unfortunate. But at least we do now see reasonably universally that people understand that schools do have to change.
It's not the why any longer. It's the how.
No,
the how.
That's
you know,
right.
You know.
Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, things like the XQ, like half those videos, you know, and the videos on their sites highlighted the fact that the traditional model of school is no longer appropriate in the modern world. And that's great. But and so the why's there. So now what we're going to start talking about is the how, and the how starts with learning. And it doesn't
but
start.
I will say again, just to end it up. And there's an echo now all of a sudden. So I'm not sure if that's coming across, but.
Yeah, I don't know.
I will say again, though, that it is, at the end of the day, we're not having the conversation about learning. you know.
That's right.
That's where it has to start, and it's not starting there. We're skipping over that. We're assuming that everybody understands what learning is, and so we're just kind of trying to figure out.
Putting an adjective in front of it.
Yeah, it's the same thing.
And you know, that's the tragedy. People don't think you can talk about learning unless you put an adjective in front of it. So that's a tragedy.
The good news, Bruce, is that I don't have any trips scheduled to the Caribbean in the near future.
That's great. So we can have a regular podcast.
Now all I got to do is get through a house closing as we downsize dramatically. So there may not be another podcast for another 2 months. I don't know. It's been like 6 weeks since we did one of these. So.
I'm going across the other side of the country today to visit.
Oh, yeah. Give my best to your daughter and your grandchild.
Right over to Perth. For those people who don't know, it's over in Western Australia. And so I'll be over there for a week. So I look forward to talking to you from there. And it's been great to get back on and talk with you again about these things.
Likewise. Cheers, mate.
Cheers, mate.
Safe travels.
Thanks, man.
So thanks again for listening, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that episode, and Bruce and I will be back again next week, barring any weather events, to bring you another episode of the Modern Learners Podcast. Don't forget, you can engage with us on our blog using our SpeakPipe app. You can join our Modern Learners Facebook group. You can find us at change.school and on Twitter and all over the place. We are always interested in the conversations that you are having and the ways in which we can push your thinking and push your bar a little bit higher when it comes to how we begin to reimagine schools for the modern world. So have a great week, everyone. Thanks again for listening, and hopefully you'll join us again next week.